This is Healthcare Strategies.
This podcast was recorded remotely due to the coronavirus pandemic. As a result, the quality may be a little lower than our usual standards. We appreciate your patience as we practice social distancing. From all of us at Xtelligent Healthcare Media, stay healthy, stay safe, and enjoy the latest episode of Healthcare Strategies.
Hello, and welcome to Healthcare Strategies. My name is Eric Wickland, and I'm the senior editor for mHealth Intelligence, one of the sites of the Xtelligent Healthcare Media Network. My guest today is Chris Woe, Vice President and Chief Innovation Officer for Sutter Health, a 24-hospital, 200-plus clinic network based in Northern California, and one of the driving forces behind the health system's recent telehealth expansion. We'll be talking today about how Sutter Health is balancing in-person care with telehealth in the wake of the coronavirus pandemic. Hello, Chris.
Hey, Eric. Thanks for having me today and excited to talk to you.
Oh, no problem at all. Let's get right into this discussion. How is Sutter Health balancing in-person and virtual care these days?
Great question. If you don't mind, I'm going to step back this one layer and articulate a little bit about what does it look like when we're done? So if we look at these two key ingredients, you know, in-person care and then virtual care, and the definition of virtual being multiple digital modalities that might be text, video, even email. You know, there's a lot of different ways that we interact with each other these days. And so for us, when we look at balancing in-person and virtual care, what we think about is extending the relationship. So when you get a chance to be with your physician, chances are that actual encounter time is pretty good. You know, you're getting sound advice, you're getting feedback, you're getting results, you're getting questions answered. The problem with it is that it's just not enough time. And so systems are overloaded, physicians are overloaded. And what we want to look at is how could we augment and enhance that relationship so it can continue after the encounter, before the encounter? And what virtual is allowing us to do is work into the everyday lives in which people are living. So it's less about, let's just replace the in-person visit with a virtual visit. What we're seeing is we're getting more inputs, we're getting more context, we're getting more family members, and we're getting more understanding around what's actually going on in people's lives and relying a little bit less about around specifically what are they saying when they come to the clinic. And so a couple of examples of this and that relationship over time would be a physician talked to said a virtual visit worked great with an elderly patient whose daughter was in another state and whose sibling was yet in another state. I believe it was Hawaii and Southern California. And what we were able to do was host a virtual visit where everyone had their questions answered and it was clear what the plan was. And that physically just would not be possible in person. So again, reinforcing this idea that we're in patient life context and not just our own is really important. I had another patient that kept coming in. He's wheelchair bound, and he told the physician each time that he'd come in that he was doing just fine. And some of the data was a little incongruent. So during the virtual visit, the physician could see his wife come into the back of the screen and said, "He's doing horribly." and the room was dark that he was in. So could understand that the patient was depressed and not managing well. And there was a lot going on in the context of his life that the physician wanted to address that never would have been seen or heard or understood in the context of our care. So what we're doing right now is in that balance, we've made a radical shift towards virtual care. Many, many thousands of people receiving virtual care every day now, which is just unprecedented. And what we're thinking about is less around, okay, this is just a simple substitute for in-person care, and more about how to integrate more family members into the care plan, how to think about the context of a patient's life, and really going where they are, not where we are, for more complete understanding. One last thing to say before we go to your next question is we were ready. So, you know, telemedicine as technology, it's been available for a while. We had been dabbling in new care models. One's called the Terra practice, where we reimagined primary care. And we said, look, let's totally rethink this. That practice was already running at 90% virtual before COVID hit. And then COVID was really the moment to large scale and create radical adoption. So for the first time ever, we saw patient demand like we'd never seen before. We saw physician demand like we'd never seen before. And we saw state and federal demand like we'd never seen before, including changes in reimbursement. So we continue to advocate for continued changes in those reimbursement boundaries so that we can continue to deliver the care in this way. But we were ready, and I think that was key, and that adoption readiness met a demand that we'd never seen. And I think advanced healthcare at minimum a decade in terms of radical adoption. The point we try to make now as innovators is this is the crack that let the light in. We're just getting started. And now this is an opportunity to rethink those relationships and family members, as I described earlier.
You'd mentioned a lot about how this strategy has been shaped by the coronavirus pandemic. Has the pandemic affected your telehealth strategy going forward? What are the lessons you might have learned from this radical shift to all virtual care?
Yeah, so moving forward, what we think about is one thing we like to say in innovation, which is 100% respectful of current delivery of care, as we say. You know, if you started from scratch right now, so if there was no such thing as healthcare delivery, would you build it the same way given this new set of tools? And the answer is typically more of a unanimous no. We would do things virtually that we couldn't do before. We would use our inpatient experiences in a slightly different way. As we talk about physicians practicing at the top of their license. So what's the pathway to that consulting and the best physician that you can find for the use case that you may need. But more importantly than all of that, I think, is the data story. So as we head forward, the idea, and I'll use the term sort of imagine if, because many of this is work that is in flight but not yet sort of hatched. The imagine if is, if you have multiple data feeds coming in from multiple parts of a user's life, and I'm going to say something very important here, which is with their consent, I think it would be very important that it's very transparent how people's life information is being incorporated for their own health benefit. So as a not-for-profit health delivery system, our objective is to keep people as healthy as possible and live as long as possible. So the quality of years and then the length of years is really, if you were to measure us and hold us to an index, that's what we'd love to be measured upon, is quality of life and length of life. And in doing that, we need more information. So the system right now can be information overloaded, but this is where AI tools, cloud tools, data tools become very interesting, because we can incorporate information. You're seeing this right now with COVID tracing, for example. We want to know if it's okay that we know this and our patient's consent. If someone's been somewhere where they've been exposed to something, that should be incorporated into the care plan. If it's okay with them, we'd like to incorporate things that they've asked us historically to see if there may be a data connection that they may not feel themselves. It might not be expressed in a symptom that a back pain is related to a headache, but we may make that correlation and be able to proactively respond. So looking at time and space in different ways. And then looking at opportunities to incorporate simple things like weather data. We talk a lot about, we've just navigated and still are navigating tremendous fires. Over 4 million acres have burned just in the area in which we deliver care. Incredible amount of pain and suffering and shifting and moving. And we don't yet incorporate, say, our medical record with weather data record. And I think we should. And that should look like this. If a fire is burning and the smoke moves, you know, allowing notifications to our asthmatic patients that we should go ahead and automatically refill inhalers and deliver them to doorsteps so there's no move needed on their part. We should do that. And we don't today because those two bits of information aren't commingled. And this goes on and on. You can look at everything from information and context on people's lives. As you watch the Internet of Things, we could know with some of our most frail patients, are they successfully getting out of bed and making breakfast? If they want us to know that, we should. And automatically that gets incorporated into the care planning. And so this all comes back to that theme around holistic understanding of people's lives and using that information to their health benefit to improve the quality and quantity of the years that they're living.
With the understanding that a lot of the access and coverage barriers have been relaxed with CMS waivers and such during the pandemic, how do you see this moving forward? What are going to be the biggest barriers to expanding telehealth?
Yeah, I think there are far more possibilities right now than there are barriers. So, you know, thinking across our ability to be with patients wherever they are, and even looking really boldly, say, if we have a patient traveling internationally, right now there are regulations that would impede care delivery in that context, but we're not sure that there should be. So looking at regulations where we can be with that patient wherever they are. The other one is just making sure that this door that really opened up around reimbursement remains open. I think that's been critical to the adoption of the care. And I believe that it will. We think in a bipartisan way, and we believe that it's in the best interest of all that the cost of care starts to come down. And we believe that that virtual care delivery does support total cost of care reductions. And we've seen evidence of that. We've got the data to prove that. And, you know, just thinking about things like mental health. So mental health, one of the main issues with mental health is it's poorly reimbursed. So strongly advocating with system leaders, very proud of a system leader I work with named John Boyd, who's been just relentless in pursuing rights for patients in mental health access. And so we could see a world where mental health is the front door. We think that in COVID, that really has brought to life that mental health is one of the first things that deteriorates prior to physical health. And we don't think the mind should be the body the way it has been historically. And so there are opportunities in regulation to, one, maintain parity to what's happened during COVID, but also continue to advocate fiercely for reimbursement and access and no denials and allowing people to get the care that they need and not wait too long. We think moving further upstream and proactive is going to help us keep people healthier in the current state as well as their future state and making sure the economics support that. So yeah, those are a few things we're thinking about. There's a lot more to that story, but that's what came to mind in your question.
You mentioned mental health. How would you apply telehealth or mHealth to improve access to mental health?
So mental health doesn't care. It's a condition that takes a fair amount of recognition and attempts at treatment. So it's not so basic as, you know, visit, prescription, end of story. And so because of that, the digitization of mental health is simultaneously critical. So for example, we launched during COVID a mental health product called Scout. And it's for youth and adolescents who've had serious anxiety and depression to the point of some type of admission, whether that's the emergency room or one of our mental health facilities. And sadly, we heard the stories from their parents and the patients themselves that, you know, you sort of get discharged and that's the beginning of what feels like a drop off. You know, like what happens next is unclear. Exactly what happens if there's an issue that night? What happens if there's an issue the next day? What happens if there's an issue a month from now? And so Scout is a digital companion for those youth and adolescent target group that really allows them to have always on care and always everyday check-ins, so that there's a constant feedback loop between the system and that patient as to what's going on. But it gets to that same point, which is the system has only so much bandwidth. The fact that it's not well reimbursed is really hindering the ability to create access. And then what happens? You know, that mental health is a condition that needs constant support, especially in the beginning. And so making sure we're there at every turn is key to what we're up to.
In mental health services and other services, what are some new ideas that you have for expanding this connected health blueprint?
Yeah. So Eric, we're looking very broadly in this space of remote monitoring and understanding someone's whole life pattern that I mentioned earlier in the call. So this is not new. This has been done for some time. What we think is really, really interesting is the exponential adoption and the number of new devices going out into the world and the information that they're spinning off. So on the one hand, that can be overwhelming. On the other hand, we think that's where algorithmic technology, as well as filtering that into its most interesting data set. So this feeling that we're trying to create is that your care team is looking out for you all the time. And so on our end, what that will look like are setting boundaries and setting filters and flagging data that looks incongruent or concerning, or on the other hand, really good.
One final question with this. You're introducing a lot of consumer-facing wearables and devices. Any concern about how to treat the information coming off of them?
Yeah, so it's really important that there are agreements in place as to how that data is handled. That's, I believe your audience will be very familiar with the BAA. And what we do there is run these through very strict privacy and security protocols before there's any start. The other thing that's really important to us is consent and awareness around how these tools are being used, what we use the information for, and making it very clear how one might opt out should they not be interested. So this certainly isn't something that we're requiring a patient to do. It's purely on their own accord if they want to participate in these tools or not. This also applies, you know, we think about everything on the continuum from everyday health to acute care. And on the opposite end of the spectrum, it would be what's possible now with like an EICU, for example, is it's not well known, but our system is in a lot of rural locations. And our ability to take, say, a world-class clinical understanding out of a vibrant city like San Francisco and be able to treat patients in some of our most rural communities. We care a lot about the underserved populations and thinking a lot about how some of this digital enhancing knowingly has created a digital divide. However, we're also seeing great gains like rural care and being able to access world-class leaders in their crafts and discipline to make sure those rural populations are receiving exceptional care. I think that's a big breakthrough. On the digital divide side, we're watching closely and locking arms with other industries. So making sure we're advocating with the state and tech leaders, et cetera, to make sure that where we're deploying these tools, we're not accidentally creating a divide. And in some ways, making sure we're starting with the underserved population, because that's a group that needs this tremendously.
Thank you very much, Chris, for taking part in this today. It's been a wonderful conversation.
Thanks, Eric. Really, really appreciate talking with you today. And thanks for everything you guys are doing to advance innovation and care.
How is your health system balancing in-person and virtual care these days? And where are the benefits and pain points? Share this episode on Twitter. Tag us at mhealthintel or me at Arrowick and tell us what you think. Thanks for listening in today.
This has been an Xtelligent Healthcare Media production.